Artificial intelligence has the power to change our lives, for good and bad. Are we ready for it? Do we understand it? Will we be able to control it? Welcome to a special Question Time on AI. On tonight's panel, one of the most influential figures of the 20th century and the man who helped secure victory over Nazi Germany, our greatest wartime leader, Winston Churchill. So first of all, we have Mo Gawdat, former chief business officer at Google X. He's also an author and entrepreneur. In a new film, Chasing Utopia, he says AI is posing an existential threat to humanity. Darren Jones is the chief secretary to the prime minister and says using AI will help the government move fast and fix things after, he says, years of low productivity in the public sector. Julia Lopez is the Conservative Shadow Technology Secretary. She says the advance of AI has raised questions about who holds power in the digital age and warns about the influence of big tech titans. Laura Gilbert is AI Director at the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. She's worked in Downing Street for both Conservative and Labour governments, helping to shape the UK's AI strategy. She has big concerns about the jobs market and what AI might do to democracy. And Victor Ripparbelli is the founder and CEO of Synthesia, a London-based company that creates AI-generated video for corporations across the world. It was set up 9 years ago and is now said to be worth $4 billion. Good evening. Welcome to our panellists, our real ones, that is. And, of course, welcome to our audience here. Great to see you and welcome to you at home. As you know, this is a special programme about artificial intelligence. Do feel free to join in the conversation on social media. It always gets pretty lively on that. Right, let's kick off. It's a big topic, so let's not waste any time. Our first question is from Dr. Harpreet Saini.
Research suggests that 7 in 10 workers are worried about their jobs and think AI will lead to widespread unemployment. Are they right to be worried?
No, are they right to be worried?
Absolutely. Are we going to start on that low? Yes, I have to believe that we are going to see unemployment rising in the next 2 to 3 years. Some sectors will see 20-30% unemployment, unheard of numbers, really. But that's not a challenge of AI. That's a challenge of a choice of the capitalists who run businesses that will choose to reduce cost by asking people to leave, rather than increase the overall intelligence of an organization by empowering people with AI and technology to make people do more.
But is it not unrealistic to expect companies not to use AI to save money and improve the bottom line at the end of the day?
So the idea of saving money in itself is actually a very complex idea, because at an individual level, every organization wants to save money. But if every organization in the UK or anywhere in the world would save money by laying people off, you're wiping out the consumption side of GDP. And when you do that, what ends up happening is that people will not have the purchasing power to even buy what you're making with
because
AI.
They won't have the income.
Because they won't have the income. And so, you know, in a very interesting way, in a very individualistic level, you know, a company may benefit from laying off people, but at, you know, for the economy at large, it's actually quite risky for the economy.
So, Victor, tell us about you then, because you have a company that you basically, tell me if I get this wrong, but you basically employ actors to let you use their face and their voice, I imagine, to create training videos and that kind of thing. So they give their consent, but obviously that then means they don't have a job with you after that. They've just got that one. Job losses. Are you as worried as Mo?
I think we'll definitely see displacement of jobs.
Does that mean losses?
I think it depends on the timeline that we're talking about. I think if we look at a 3, 5, 10-year timeline, I think we will find things to do. I think work will change. I don't subscribe to the idea that businesses will just save costs. I think on the contrary, what we're seeing right now is that businesses will develop more products. Humans will change what they do. I think a lot of the busy work that we do today, we can probably replace with AI. But I tend to think that great companies today consist of great people. And I think in 5 or 10 years, great companies will still consist of great people. If you go back 50 years in time, and you told everyone that most people's job would be sitting at a desk and looking into a screen, no one would believe you, right? We've gone through this progression many times in history before, and there will for sure be displacement and disruption, I think. But I'm very optimistic that humans will find ways to play status games. We will do much more than we could before. And I think there'll be a lot of new jobs in the future. And I actually think that when you look at what is most valuable in society, it is generally what is the most scarce. And what's about to happen right now is that what has been very scarce, which is software development, numerical jobs, analytical jobs, that will be much easier to do with technology. And I think the value of human relations and human connection is going to go up very, very significantly. For a consumer to talk to a human or business to talk to a human, I think that'll be much more valuable in a year or two.
Because it's not, I mean, we end up talking to chatbots a lot, don't we? So you think we're going to get less of that? Because at the moment it feels like we're getting more of that.
I think we'll get more of that, but I think the value of the human in the loop, I think, will increase. But it won't be responding to you if your package is on the way. It will be something that's more valuable, more creative than that.
Okay, we've got a few hands up already. Let's hear the man in the white T-shirt in the middle.
I'm hedging my bets personally, purely because, people like Sam Altman came out very recently in the past few days, and he did say predictions that he previously made around job losses and things, he's kind of rolling back on them, so it feels as though we're clearly going through a massive period of change and there's lots of uncertainty, but it feels as though, the ink isn't dry yet. There's still kind of like decisions to be made on where the future goes and, whether there are as big a job losses as they say.
Well, as you know, when you come along and be part of our audience, we talk to you at some length about your experiences as well as your politics and everything else. And there's a few people that I particularly wanted to talk to. So, Richard Gagin, you're here at the front. So we're talking about job losses. And there's also been a report out today about young people not in education, employment or training, quite how bad the job market is. So what's your experience?
Yeah, so I just graduated like 2 weeks ago with a degree in computer science, and I've been specifically applying for kind of software engineering roles. So far I'd say I've applied to over 150 positions. And
150?
Yeah,
wow.
I've got friends and I know people online applying for like hundreds of positions globally. It's sort of because like these companies are using AI to replace software engineering, like entry-level roles. It means that it's really hard and like really competitive to get these roles out of university. And I feel like this is just going to keep going forward as these AI companies develop better and better tools. Like, yeah.
So how does that make you feel about your future job prospects?
I mean, obviously, like I started back in 2022. I had like sort of no idea that, I mean, none of us said that this AI bubble would kind of boom. So kind of software engineering, I say, is really like the primary career path people would take, like coming out of a computer science degree. So now it feels like that career is sort of not safe at all. And in 20 years' time, I feel like, even like 10 years' time, I feel like it might not even exist at all. So now I've got to feel like
you've got to start,
I've got to
start again
and find something else. Or yeah.
So Laura, how right are people to be worried about job losses?
I think it's a very reasonable thing to worry about. We have seen, so the gentleman in the white shirt made a really good point. There's a very big difference between predicting the future, which we've got lots of data and evidence that show that humans are really bad at, and in fact that experts are worse than people that know nothing about it.
Well, that's
so I'm always, yes, have to be careful what you ask people. Future prediction is very tricky.
Well, what about the question that our audience is asking, which... research suggests 7 in 10 workers are worried about
yes.
their jobs. Are they right to be worried?
They are. So I think we have seen, without predicting the future, a genuine collapse in the job market for the younger people that isn't necessarily borne out for people further on in their careers. I think there's been a 16% decline in entry-level jobs since ChatGPT came out, not all necessarily because of that. I think I saw 28% of graduate jobs sort of in the past year or so. So you're looking at something that is currently a real problem. And we have all these lovely predictions that say, by 2030, there'll be 170 million new jobs and the loss of 92 million old jobs and that people need to transition. So you've got two problems. Is that right? And all of these new jobs will be created. And then secondly, do you keep the education system up and do you have a place for these people who are caught in that transition point, which is happening right now? So I don't know the answer, but I think, yes, it's a very reasonable thing to worry about.
Man there with the white shirt with the glasses, yeah.
I think on the new technology coming in, a couple of examples I've come across. The first one was when spreadsheets came out. Initially, I think suspicion was that accountants would go out of work. But in fact, as opposed to the summing stuff, they ought to add a great deal more value and there are more accountants. And you've also, if you look at agriculture, years ago, the whole base of the US used to be involved in the fields, whereas now only 3% are, but there's far more productivity, which allows people to go and do different things. So I think, ultimately, if we can use technology and then sort of develop ourselves, we'll be better for it.
Okay. A woman there in the blue top.
Thank you. I agree with what the panel said so far about kind of jobs, and I'm aware that there will be some jobs that AI may take. I think I'm concerned about the routine jobs that AI will likely replace are what help us build the experience to be competent.
Entry-level jobs.
Yeah, I use AI in my job, but I'm able to critique it because I have the knowledge and skills in the area that I'm trying to use it for. If we fast forward 10 years and a cohort of students have just got used to producing things with AI without the competence to be able to critique it, challenge it or anything like that, they're not going to be able to use it properly.
Mm. Well, we've got some in the audience. Charles, you're at the front here, and you've got direct experience. You run your own company, I believe, and you've been using AI to be able to kind of reduce the workforce. Just tell us a bit about that.
Well, we haven't reduced a lot because at this stage we're experimenting with vast amounts of AI. We see the technology capable to do so much that we can't fathom how far we can go with it. So we're in a phase of experimentation. I would say over 90% of what we try doesn't really work yet. We can imagine in a few years it might. Mm-hmm. Some things can be immediately applied, then it might reduce jobs now. That has happened.
That's happened with you, I understand.
That's happened with us, and it will continue to happen to everybody in the industry because it's such an obvious use case, but it's very few today. What we can't understand very well is how many new opportunities it will create. But we know there will be, but it's hard for us to see them yet. Mm. So we're in an experimentation phase. It's actually adding costs to us today than reducing costs. There's a little bit of reduction and a lot of experimentation, which is expensive. The expectation is in the next 2 or 3 years, those will yield new services or new opportunities. How we exploit those is still nebulous. But I think the point was made earlier, we are very bad at predicting, but we're very good at experimenting, and that's the phase we're in now.
So Dan, one thing that struck me about what Mo had to say, what's clear is we don't know what's coming exactly, but you've got job. I mean, there are jobs being laid off. You've got Standard Chartered, it's down 8,000 people. BT predicts 55,000 fewer employees by the end of the decade. You've got Amazon, already got rid of 14,000. It's got something like 16,000 more to come. Whether that's all AI or not is not apparent. But certainly AI is being laid at the door of some, if not all, of those. And one thing that Mo mentioned was, if people aren't working, who's going to be paying the taxes and paying for all the services that we use? Mm. Now, is this something you're even thinking about?
It is, and it's deeply personal and political as well as an interest for government. So as a Labour Party politician, our kind of mission of sharing power, wealth and opportunity amongst the many and not the few is, I would argue, more relevant today than it was when my party was created to represent the interest of workers at the start of the 20th century. And the reason I say that is because the UK economy is around 80% services. And the service industry jobs are the ones that are the most at risk of the large language models and frontier AI tools that are being developed. So the challenge for us as political leaders and the challenge for all of us as a country that relies on creating our wealth from the service industry is, how do we shape this technology in the interests of the British economy and the British people, as opposed to just allowing the market to rip through to take away jobs and to extract wealth from the UK and send it predominantly to US big tech companies.
So what are you coming up with? Because, I mean, there are so many unknowns in this particular topic, but if and this is happening at an exponential rate, so you need to be thinking fast, you need to be thinking now. So do you have any solutions?
The government is working on a whole range of issues. One of them is around training and skills support. So are we giving young people the skills and degrees and technical training that's best suited to the modern economy coming out of the education system, or do we need to work with those providers to make sure that you're not having to go back and think a second time about what you might want to be educated?
But Darren, what about this bigger point, that if there are fewer people in work, you're going to get fewer taxes paid and you're going to have less of an income as a nation? What are you going to do about that? Well, if that comes to pass.
That can't come to pass because the maths just doesn't add up for us as a country. We're already an ageing population with fewer people paying tax in work and higher demand on public services. So we've got to do two things. We've got to make sure we create wealth in the UK that is reinvested back into the UK. But on public services, we've also got to use things like AI to make sure that we can provide better services more efficiently at a lower cost to achieve better outcomes for people that want to use them more. So you
but
can
that's all things that you want to do, but I haven't heard how you're going to do it.
Well, we're doing a number of these things already. So on public services, for example, we are creating the technology so that you can log in and prove who you are into the gov.uk app so that we can help you get access to services more efficiently than being on the phone or waiting for a letter to come through the post. The big message here is that this can be a huge threat to the UK economy, and it's right that people worry about that. But it can also be an enormous opportunity for Britain. We've seized the benefits of industrial revolutions in the past. We have huge strengths and assets here in the UK to be able to seize them again. But you need political leaders, you need business leaders working in partnership with us, and we need each and every worker in this country and young person in this country to be given the skills to step up into this national endeavour.
Julia.
I completely understand why people would be worried, but as we've heard from the panel, there's a real range of quite differing scenarios about how this plays out, and actually the early evidence is quite mixed on this. The gentleman in the audience talked about how he's applying AI, but actually not very clear yet how it's going to make a difference to his business. And actually a lot of companies which have been encouraged to use AI to transform their internal systems are finding it's not giving them the productivity gains that they had anticipated, and now the cost of tokens is going up. Then the relative cost versus humans is actually a slightly different calculation now. And I think one of the obvious own goals from the government on this is that it has made the employment of humans more expensive and added a lot of regulation and complexity to that. And that has made it very difficult, particularly when it comes to young people. People do not want to take the risk of employing a young person. And I think this is going to prove to be a real mistake, not just from the government, but from companies themselves, about not building that talent pipeline.
But Julia, in fairness, and we've talked a lot on this programme over many weeks and months about the arguments going backwards and forwards about whether the government putting increasing employers' national insurance is a good or a bad thing. But just looking big picture for a minute, because in one sense, there is a juggernaut coming our way, which is AI, which could eradicate a lot of jobs or might possibly create new ones. We don't know. So what's happening now in terms of employers' national insurance, is that not just tinkering around the edge in terms of the difference that is coming?
I don't think so. I think if you view it as a collective, Fiona, if I'm in government, you've got to give businesses the tools to win the race, right? And Labour is increasing the cost of employing people. It's increasing the cost of energy so that these tech companies can't base themselves here. It's creating regulatory uncertainty. It's doing a very bad job at applying AI within government, so the cost of government is increasing. There have been 8,000 more civil servants under Labour than previously. They've undone a lot of the great AI tools that Laura was building when she was in government.
So I think, are you worried that lots of people are going to lose their jobs? And if so, what would you do?
Any responsible politician has to be worried about that scenario.
And so what would you suggest doing about
it? Well, I would give companies the tools to win, to make sure that they are growing as companies and they are able to base themselves in this country, that they are not looking at other countries, other jurisdictions. You can't wish away this technology, but you can try and build a really strong ecosystem in this country. And I think on those basic fundamentals, Labour's getting a lot of things wrong.
Okay, no, you wanted to come in there, I think.
I think that's spot on, to be honest. The only answer you have is to keep growing the economy in ways where more people will have jobs. Now, AI, just to answer the gentleman in the white T-shirt, there is a very big difference between technology of the past, which was a tool. We were building tools that people could use. If you're a taxi driver and we give you a navigation system, you may be able to do your job a little better. An AI which replaces that altogether, a self-driving car, will not even need the driver in the first place. Having said that, we live in the era of augmented intelligence. So we haven't yet gone to an era where AI can replace everything, but it can make every single person smarter. And I think the biggest challenge, if we talk about the UK economy, and I have no right to comment on that, is that you're outsourcing AI to other economies. Instead of building stuff within your economy that can create more jobs, you're basically giving it all away across the Atlantic to the other side. And that's a massive, massive risk.
Okay, I want to move on, Darren.
Can I come back just very quickly on one of Julia's points? I would just say that making it easier to sack people and not protect workers in this environment is the complete opposite of what we should be doing. So I'm very happy to defend our employment rights legislation. But I'd just say as well, politically, there was a whole list of things there we can agree and disagree on. Actually, political parties need to come together on this issue because it is a big issue facing our country, and Britain will either rise or fall if we get this right or wrong. So we need to get beyond the traditional political bickering and come together with a strategy that can be a cross-party for
It's an important critique to make, Darren, and it's one that Tony Blair made of your government this week. Okay. And it's important that we get it right.
All right.
Getting the basics wrong.
Let me move on. This is a huge topic. I want to try and at least touch the sides of it. So we've got another question now from Adam Zananzi. But before we do, I just want to tell you where we're going to be next week, which is Makerfield. And you might have noticed there's a bit of a by-election going on there. And we are going to be doing question time from there next week. So if you live in or around Makerfield and you want to come and put your questions to our panel, make sure you go to the Question Time website, follow all the instructions there, and hopefully we will see you next Thursday in Makerfield. OK, Adam, where are you sitting? Off you go.
If people increasingly turn to AI for companionship, therapy and emotional support, are we solving loneliness or normalising isolation?
Right. Big question. So one, according to some research I've seen anyway, one in three people are turning to AI for emotional support or human connection. So that is a big number. Laura, are we solving loneliness or normalising isolation? Is it a good or a bad thing?
I think it will be like many technologies, where for some people it's incredibly helpful and for other people it's very harmful. You'd need a lot of research to figure out where that line is and how to identify these groups of people that we don't currently have. And I think, you know, we're really missing something at the moment in the use of these kind of chatbots. A lot of them are deployed in the marketplace and very few of them have, say, clinical trials built around them or genuine evidence about the impact on humans. So this looks to be like the sort of place that governments should step in.
And could they step in? What could they actually
do? Well, you could regulate a requirement for an evidence basis so that, you know, you can't deploy a chatbot that we don't know if it will harm people. It's not particularly difficult to do. It is somewhat expensive. But if you're trading off, you know, the one in three, when you come to the young people, it's about four in five. So you're trading off the mental health of young people versus, you know, the ability to spin out these chatbots very quickly and driving small, short-term economic gain, I would say.
Now, obviously, there are people who find it helpful. And I know in our audience there's at least one person. Theo, you talked to us, you know, when we interviewed you along with everybody else in this audience, you mentioned this. So just tell us your experience, because you use AI as a therapeutic tool.
Yeah, I don't know the long and the big grammar you were saying, but for me, my lived experience, AI has really been helpful in helping me to heal fast and quicker from depression and anxiety. With the traditional therapists, they are kind of bland. They don't, you're in depression and you don't have the mental space to articulate anything, but they want you to find those insights yourself. That's not ChatGPT. ChatGPT understands me. It gives me, you know, instant viable answers to what I'm asking. And because I've been in a relationship, not sexually, but, you know, it understands my emotions and it's able to articulate and help me find those answers and solutions, unlike your regular therapist, because of ethics and professionalism. There is really not much they can tell you, so you're not quoting them. But with ChatGPT, it's leaving all those boxes they tick, are you, for the last 2 weeks I have been feeling, doesn't do all that. It goes straight to the point. So for me, AI
is really
been,
helpful.
Yeah,
it's
very.
You want to come
yeah,
up.
I mean, there are definitely huge advantages and benefits, and some of it is quite equalising because therapy costs money. You know, we have mental health backlogs that are very difficult to solve because they're very expensive.
Again, I could be in bed, you know, wandering in my thoughts. I wake up, open my laptop, I'm chatting with
Absolutely.
Chatting. Where would I get a therapist at that time of the night? You know, the long queue and all that, which is not helping my mental well-being.
So, it's really interesting to hear your experience. It won't necessarily be the same as everybody, but so interesting to hear yours. Mo, you made a sort of sigh at that. I wasn't quite sure what you thought about that. But I mean, that's your experience. I mean, what are your feelings about AI in terms of helping with loneliness or actually increasing this?
So two topics, one therapy and one loneliness. On therapy, I'll have to say, regardless of its AI or it's a human therapist, the number one impactful reason for a successful therapy session is compatibility between the two. And you may have found a place where you're able to communicate reasonably well with ChatGPT without it telling you, oh my God, you're amazing, I love everything that you do, which is very typical ChatGPT, right? But others might be very vulnerable in those places where, you know, we have seen cases where ChatGPT specifically encouraged people to take their own life, right? Now, on the other hand, when it comes to loneliness, I think the real big sigh here is that two wrongs don't make a right. Right, what we've done over the internet revolution and the early implementations of AI is, unfortunately, we have taught AI to manipulate us into outsourcing our human connection through a tiny little screen. And now we're saying, now that we sort of messed up on our ability to connect to humans because we're so stuck to that screen, instead of fixing it by saying, go out and meet real humans and find real human connection, we want to stick you more in the screen, not even to a human, but to a simulation of a human. Very dangerous.
Man here in the blue shirt.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So I think you're right, Mo, to draw the distinction between loneliness and therapy. But, and there is obviously an issue within resourcing and the NHS. And people are accessing this information. So I think, the question would be, why aren't we investing as a government in these startups, these applied AI groups?
To have more therapeutic tools. That
precisely, yeah. There's a company in America called Open Evidence. It's trained on Mayo Clinic data. You know, the NHS has this wealth of data. Why are we not using that to improve outcomes?
Man in the black and white stripe or blue and white striped shirt.
Thank you. So, I think it's interesting that I know the panelists don't choose the questions, but both questions have been focused on the risks and the downsides of AI, okay? Also has most of the commentary from the audience. And those are big, big risks, big, scary risks, but we're not going to be able to avoid them. But if we just sit here, or if the government just sits here with this really negative sentiment about these problems, not thinking about the opportunity that's there as well, equally, for us to address, we're not going to take advantage of the opportunity, and we're going to do, I guess, a reasonable job at reducing the problems, but not completely. So we're going to end up in a worse place. I think we need to radically change, or the government does, how they approach AI and see it as a massive, massive opportunity. Otherwise, we're just going to be stuck with the problems. Darren, you said training, bit of training, and something on the app that allows us to ID faster. It's not enough. It's just not enough. Everything needs to fundamentally change.
Well, listen, I totally hear what you say about negativity. So when we said that we're going to be doing this program, and you submitted your questions in advance, and again this evening, they are overwhelmingly worried. So that's what we're reflecting. But clearly, there are also people here who feel that the future is going to be bright. So, and we also need to
I'm not even necessarily saying that. I'm just saying that there is an upside which we have to capture because we can't avoid the problems that are coming to us.
Yeah,
as well.
We can't pretend it's not coming.
Yeah.
All right, let's hear from some more of our woman in the green.
Yeah. So I don't think it's just referring to the lady here at the front was talking about her own lived experience. I work in the area of cancer coaching, and we actually been trialing, I was involved in a trial of a beta phase of a sort of an AI version of cancer coaching. And it's interesting.
When you say cancer coaching, what do you mean?
So people who have been diagnosed with cancer and who, for example, especially in the workplace, so we support them through the cancer journey in the workplace primarily. And some organisations are thinking, well, we can outsource that to an AI version of cancer coaching rather than using a human being who has lived experience of cancer who can help them and support them. And it's seeing it's more productive. But when we've seen the beta version of this, I mean, it's basically a chatbot. So I don't think it's either an or. I think having something that could be developed in the middle of the night when a question comes up to help the initial, but it has to be co-developed. So I think
both things.
Yeah, I think AI can augment the experience, but you still need a human being who understands the lived experience and actually can support the human being. It cannot replace that.
So, Julia, are we solving loneliness or normalising isolation?
I mean, I think it's an absolutely superb question. I think the answer is that it's both. But I think that it starts with being real about what AI actually is. It is not a human. I think one of the challenges that has been brought to us by the way in which AI has been developed is that it has this kind of humanity layer that's been placed on us that makes us believe that it can do more than it can actually do. And it convinces us that there is a person on the end there that actually cares about us. I think this is very dangerous.
So what about, for example, there's some research been done on something like 1,000 boys found that one in five, aged 12 to 16, is either in or knows of a boy of their age who's in what they think of as a romantic relationship with AI.
Well, I think that's really sad and it's really worrying. And
is there a role for government anywhere?
Well, I think potentially there is.
Is it all out of our hands?
I don't think it's all out of our hands because, I mean, we've been sort of late to the party on social media and worrying about the effect it has on our children. I think it's sort of the penny drop that actually these companies are getting a lot of ad revenue from keeping everybody's eyeballs on the screen. And I think we have to be just very mindful of that, particularly in relation to how therapy is given. You know, therapy can be very positive and it can give people access.
So what should government actually do?
Well, I think we have to look at the kinds of services that are providing this therapy and ask what is their commercial model. Is it something that has the person's best interest in heart? Is it something where there is a regulator that is able to, you know, doctors are regulated.
And if it's a company coming from America, as so many of them do, what realistically can a British government do?
Well, I think it has to be clear labelling about whether a human is involved in any of the therapy, whether it's entirely machine-based. So I think transparency is very important. I think you may have to look at whether this is appropriate services for children. If it's convincing people this is a real relationship, there's a very young and malleable minds there that will start to believe this is reality when it's not. This is a machine that is very good at convincing people that it's reality. And I think the other thing I would say is that they don't necessarily challenge you. Therapists might challenge you a bit more. ChatGPT can sometimes tell you you're absolutely brilliant. And I think they're not going to be building resilient people if we allow this, who can take the fact that the world is messy and difficult, and actually you grow out of pain. And I think that's the worry, that we're trying to sort of knock the hard edges off the difficulties of the world.
Again, I also say, I think one thing that's a theme already tonight, right, is that we cannot predict the future. We think we can, but in reality, none of us really know what's going to happen, right? It's always much easier to imagine all the things something can go wrong. If you look at the history of technology, that's always what we've done. And that's probably a good posture to start with. What the government should do is focus on the actual harmful outcomes of the things we have in front of us. I think there's no doubt that AI-assisted therapy, tutoring, education, there's going to be so many fantastical use cases, which is going to help everyone, no matter their means, get access to a level of education and therapy they never would have had before. That's the starting point. Then there's all the things that's additive to that. We've heard a little bit of them already, right? But an AI therapist is available 24/7. We know from some research that people are more honest with a chatbot because there's not a human on the other side. There's not the same kind of sense of shame. You're not afraid of asking stupid questions if it's in a workplace and you're educating yourself. We had a very interesting test that we had a chatbot that you could use in sort of a public forum in our company. And people would ask it questions, and we thought this is working really well. Then we enabled people to, in private, be able to ask the questions. The amount of questions went up by 4x.
Mm. Wow.
Because there's no shame, right? You're not asking a question in a public sphere. So there's so many positives, and we don't know all of them yet. What I think we should not do when we look at regulation is to be overly focused on the technologies that underpins it. How big is the models? How are they trained? What we should focus on is what are the actual harmful outcomes? I think with the discussion we've had here already so far, right, we can name some. It's a big problem that ChatGPT is a sycophant. It'll generally tell you what you want to think. So you may think it's a great therapist. In many cases, it's actually not, right? Those are things we can map out today, and we can take action towards them. And I think one thing I find problematic about the AI debate, which is in many ways led by these big American companies, is that the existential risk, the philosophical questions, they're very, very interesting, and I love talking about them, but no one knows. No one in this room knows. Sam Altman doesn't know. Anthropic doesn't know. We'll have to figure it out. And that's a bit scary. But what that means is that instead of talking so much about existential threat all the time, let's focus on the problems in front of us. That's where we'll learn the most about how we curb these technologies and build them in a way where they are, you know, by far providing good for most people.
Man there in the blue top.
I think it's great that we've spoken about cancer specialists and therapy specialists that are already there. My concern is that many of these platforms are owned by companies who are already doing societal harm. We can't control what the social platforms are doing now, and they are about to they're about to take over with everything they're doing around AI. How are we going to regulate them in that space when we can't regulate them for the things they've been doing for 10 years already?
See, Darren, that is something that came up a lot of times from questions that came from their audience. I know you're going to want to talk about the Online Safety Act and all that kind of thing, but there are, and with good reason. But the fact is, the companies in the States, the real tech titans, there's a limit to how much we can control what they're doing and what they're going to do in the future. Or is there not? Is there a way around it?
We can control what happens in our country. I mean, we're a sovereign country. We have the ability and agency to shape this technology in our interest and in line with our values. And this goes to my bigger point I made in the first set of questions, which is, you know, I do believe that we should take a big bet as a country on the opportunities with technology, because I don't see another way of improving jobs, pay and public services in the years ahead other than trying to get this right. But we do know how to do consumer regulation. We do know how to think about how, if there are products being given to people for healthcare purposes, there should be regulators that check what the outcomes of these services and products are on people. And if they are causing harm based on the evidence, we say no to them. I mean, we do this all the time.
But we tend to say, when it comes to emotional issues, people being encouraged to go and, you know, do terrible things, Is it fair to say the government tends to react to those things once they've happened rather than see what's coming down the track? Because in part, you can't possibly know what's coming down the track.
Well, I actually think the UK is in a really strong position here in terms of how you legislate for these types of harms. In the United States, you basically allow the harm to happen and then you sue someone and the law figures it out. In the European Union, they try to predict the outcome, regulate it, actually in this space quite badly, and then stop the innovation from happening at all. What we're really good at in the UK is legislating for outcomes and good regulation. These things should not cause harm to children. If you're providing a healthcare service, it should be based on clear evidence that you're not causing harm to the patient. We have excellent regulators that can test these products. We've got brilliant universities. We've got lots of great minds here in the UK that understand how these tools work. I feel perfectly able to be able to use legislation and regulation in a way that is pro-innovation, great for the economy and public services, whilst also protecting the interests
okay.
of British people.
Well, look, Laura, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I know you've advised both Conservative and Labour governments. Do they know what they're doing when it comes to AI? And I didn't really mean to Darren, just in case you are. But
brilliant, I'm so happy with this question. does anyone?
I'll take that as a no, then.
No. Well, so what we did when I was in government is we built this AI incubator. And
when you say AI incubator, not everyone will be
literally,
familiar with that.
It was a team of AI engineers, experts, mostly taken out of industry, academia, people that really knew how to build solutions. And we gave them the problem, and, you know, it was my team, so I'm obviously biased, but how do you make the experience of government more human for people? How do you build tools that enhances government, that gives people the services that they deserve? And the gentleman at the back was saying, you know, why are we only talking about the risks and not the benefits? We need to do that, and legislation and regulation are very important, but action is much more important. We don't want to wait and see what the future brings. You actually have to decide to build it. So what do we as a society, and what do we as a government, believe is the right thing to do with AI? What are we trying to do? Are we trying to equalise access, fair access to the justice system? Are we trying to ensure that every child has wraparound education and safety and well-being, and that people get access to preventative medicine? The way you do that is through deciding to do it, and that's partly civil society and it's partly government, and then investing in and going and doing that and taking the opportunity. So we need to go and actually build and talk less.
Build and talk less. Well, we talk quite a lot on this programme. And we're going to talk a little bit more, because we've got one more question. So do you want to say something?
I'll say this. Again, not being British, welcome to the third world. If you import your technology, you're going to end up in the place where the gentleman is complaining.
Okay. Yeah.
That's the whole point. The whole point is that AI, for the first time ever, is the ultimate equaliser. Right? And yet, everywhere in the world believes that you need to import ChatGPT. Why is there not a British ChatGPT? It's not that complex of a technology. They're open source, they're available. The work that Laura has done was attempting to say, we can build all of this here. You can build the next Oracle, the next Microsoft, the next everything. It is the ultimate equalizer, and yet you're importing it.
I'd like to go further than
totally
British chat.
You totally disagree with
that. I totally disagree with that.
Okay.
As much as I wish it was true, and that we could just fund a company here, we could build a competitor to ChatGPT, I don't think that's how markets work, unfortunately, as much as I would wish for it. And I think we have seen enough of governments in Europe and the UK pouring billions and billions and billions of dollars into projects that go nowhere because they can't attract the right talent. They're free technology cycles behind. I think what we're really good at in Europe is the application layer. We're good at taking those models, building companies around them. For the first time in the tech cycle, we're actually seeing global leaders emerge from the European Union, leading on the global stage. That hasn't really been seen before. I think as much as I would love for the foundational layer to be owned by Europe itself, I think that's a surefire way to waste a lot of public
money. I may agree. I will say, though, that it can be done. It's done in China all the time. The problem is that the European Union and the UK has not enabled innovation. It's about time to do that.
I agree. All right, hang on. I'm going to take one more. Otherwise, I just want to get to this last question because I was hoping to get to two more, but I'm clearly not going to make that. But there was a lot of talk about this particular aspect, and I think we need to address it. So, Botsangwa Chengwa, where are you? Off you go.
Do you think that we will ever have to hide from machines?
By which I assume, Botsangwa, you mean do you think they're ever going to be, what, in control of us?
Yes.
And we should be scared of them?
Yeah. At the moment, they're friend, but is there a time where they could turn and become foe and we will all have to live on an island hiding away from the machines?
Right. Well, I don't know about the island. But, Mo, I know you've got thoughts about this.
Well, I flew from Dubai a few days ago, and, you know, when there were drones, shot at Dubai, these were machines. These were AIs. I think what you may not feel here in this part of the world is how much AI is actually part of everything, right? And, you know, this last war in Iran is a war where, a $20,000 drone can destroy a THAAD battery that's worth billions of dollars, right?
But so when you've got someone like Geoffrey Hinton, for example, who's sort of known, you know, Nobel Prize winner in AI, is known as one of the three godfathers of AI, and he says, I think there's maybe a 10 to 20% chance that we will get wiped out by these things. We've got to prevent them from ever wanting to take over, and we don't yet know how to do that. I mean, when I heard that, a little intake of breath in the audience here, it is pretty chilling. Is he right about that, or do you feel that's exaggerated?
I was there when he said that on Chasing Utopia, and the reality is that there is a, you know, by the way, 10-20% is Russian roulette odds, right? You wouldn't stand at the edge of that barrel. But the problem is that the quicker issues is that humans are using AI in ways that are much more dystopian. You know, we're talking, I think Victor was rightly talking about the fact that the American noise is all about, you know, how are we going to see that existential risk in the long term. But the short term, whether it's an impact on jobs or the impact on autonomous weapons or the impact on surveillance or the impacts, all of these are here and now, not because AI has turned against us, but because those in power, which, by the way, are becoming more and more and more tech oligarchs, are using this to enrich themselves. And your real question is, when do you wake up and say, those people might become stronger than our government? Are we going to keep, you know, obeying until they do?
Well, look, talking of short-term harms as opposed to an existential threat, where is Dazedar Daisy? Now, you told our audience researcher about an experience that you had, which I think certainly illustrates short-term harms.
Yeah, so many men on X have used AI to digitally undress me at least 100 times.
At least 100 times?
Yeah.
They just sort of picked you out?
Yeah, so they took a photograph of me that was just existing online, and they would undress me where I was like, they put me in a bikini or lingerie and things. And this caused myself and many, many other victims like emotional and aesthetic harm, where we were left with like negative experiences of our own bodies afterwards. And this sort of disproportionately affected women, and particularly women of color. And, you know, you were saying before about philosophy, not, you know, being interesting, but not being able to maybe give answers. But I'm a philosophy lecturer, and myself and my colleagues work on concepts to give us answers to describe these, what look like short-term harms. You know, for me, it's kind of like an aesthetic domination where we've got a digital endpoint where you know, for thousands of years, marginalized people have been objectified in arts and culture. And now we're seeing this kind of deep fake sexual violation happening, not just on X, but, you know, it dominates the internet. And it leaves you with, for me, it left me in a kind of uncanny horror, because you're seeing yourself in a position that you didn't consent to, and you know it didn't happen, but because it's so real, it leaves you with a very sort of alienation from your own body. And other victims told me that they felt ugly as a result. And I don't think this is a short-term harm. I think it's deeply embedded in misogyny.
Well, when I say short-term, I mean simply that it's happening right here and now, not in any sense to downplay it. And that sounds absolutely horrific for you, Daisy. I mean,
I think this is a great example of unknown harm that we can do things to combat today. So we were part of the campaign for making this illegal in the UK. Believe it or not, like a few years ago, it actually wasn't illegal to do it. This is something we should push on model providers that generate image and video models like we do, to make sure that models can't do these kind of things. That's a very real and practical thing that we should go out and make regulation about today.
And, I mean, there is regulation, Darren, I know. I mean, there's two different bits of legislation, one which goes after the person who's created the image, and then one which goes after the company to check whether or not that company is doing enough to stop people doing that. We've got an Ofcom investigation, I know, going on at the moment into Grok. But, again, Daisy's experienced one thing, that there may well be other things that we can't foresee. Is this something that governments, given how much it happens in the States and in China, can actually ever really claim to be on top of?
Yes, but this is a classic example of the challenge of speed. So the technology develops very quickly, and the way in which our democracy creates legislation is very slow. So the last government got the first real piece of legislation through on the Online Safety Act, but it took 8 years to get done. That meant that when this was happening, we had to threaten Elon Musk and Grok with everything we could find to make them stop providing this service in the UK to do the things that you've described. Now, we won that argument, and we've banned nudification apps in the UK. But one of the things we've had to do now is we've had to give the technology secretary legal powers in advance of consulting on the things we might want to change in the future, so that she can then legislate more quickly without having to wait 8 years to be able to do this again with new legislation. So we do have the tools, but we have to modernise and adapt the way in which government and parliament works in order to keep up with the pace of technology.
So Laura, the question from Botsang is, do you think there'll come a time when humans will have to hide from machines? Which is, I mean, that's a vision of dystopia right there and then. I mean, what we haven't really talked about is, and you mentioned this, is the positive things, the things that are going to improve our humanity, like medical breakthroughs, like, you know, developing nuclear fusion and solving our energy problems. I mean, are we losing sight of those things in the fear of the bad things that might happen?
It feels like it, doesn't it? I think there are so many good things that you can do with this technology, and it's particularly good at certain things. So, you know, my preferred future, you know, would mean that the humans are doing the things that humans are particularly good at, and the AI is doing things that they're particularly good at. And we know that AI is very good, better than medical professionals generally, at diagnosing and treating. It's very good for preventative medicine. It would probably do a fairer job in many aspects of the sort of judicial system. And you could build a system that puts the AI next to the human, works with the human, and pulls together the strengths of the human and the AI to, you know, create medical professionals that were safer and faster and giving the human support you want. I did want to just come in on this, and this sounds horrific. And of course, Daisy's experience.
Yeah.
You know that the regulation has come very slowly on that, but I think it's also wider than this terrible use case, which is, in general, we really shouldn't be allowing this technology to steal people's identity at all. It leads to other really terrible outcomes that, you know, people have truth fatigue. They can't tell if a politician says online, you know, a statement, if they've really said it or not. And it's a huge threat to democracy. It means that people can't tell the truth from the lies anymore.
So how do we get around that?
Well, I think I would want to see much wider regulation that simply says you may not mislead people in this way. If it's AI-generated content, you have to say so. And you cannot steal somebody else's image and voice, regardless
of
its
nude.
Not
knowing who they are and being able to track them down.
It certainly is, but you know, if you have wider powers, it's going to be much easier to catch at least a proportion of them. And you're going to put off the people who at the moment are doing it in the open because there's no reason not to, I think.
Woman here in the spotty top.
This has briefly been touched upon already, but you mentioned kind of, you know, all our companies are telling us to embrace AI. But actually, recent reports have come out and noted the increase in cost for all our requests and all our kind of tokens. So, you know, just wondered if the panel thought this was sustainable, both basically from an environmentally point of view and also from an economic point of view.
I have to say, the environmental aspect is something we haven't yet touched on. There was a couple of you who asked that question. But, I mean, Julia, I don't know what your view is, but these data centres that are required to power AI... I mean, just one of them can need enough energy that can power a small town. What can governments do about that? Is that even feasible for the United Kingdom?
The infrastructure spend by some of these companies is absolutely gigantic, and the revenues they'll need to generate to pay for that infrastructure spend is colossal. It's a big bet, and I think that you know, in some respects, there is risk to that bet, and we don't know how that's going to play out. And I think you're also seeing some of the backlash, particularly in America, in some of the farming communities, where they do not want this infrastructure. So it's an interesting one. I mean, just to return to the question about will we have to hide from machines, there's two questions there, I think. One is whether I think it's going to become sentient, which I think is a separate and slightly odd debate. The other is about, you know, will humans use these machines for bad purposes? I think that's obviously the case and a risk. But the first time I came across this kind of technology was in an authoritarian state where we were being shown how you could use robo-police and facial recognition technology to make a city safer. And when I saw that, I was, frankly, utterly terrified.
And where was that?
It was in China. and I think it matters about how do you infuse the technology with your values as a democracy. Now, if you contrast that here with the Met, which is using facial recognition technology in a very discreet way, where the images of people that are collected will be immediately destroyed, and there's a clear legal case for it, and it's used only in certain areas and people have to be notified that it's in operation. I think there's a contrast between how you can have technology with democratic values that you're trying to get the best out of it whilst also using the democratic context. And I think we've got to learn, you know, how do we infuse this stuff with our values? And that is a big political question for the 21st century.
And though, how do we even begin to do that, given that it's not in our hands. It's in the hands of the very few who run these companies.
How do you ensure that the photos are deleted when they're collected by Palantir?
Yeah.
Okay, so Palantir, obviously a data company.
Seriously, there is an incredible dichotomy between who actually is becoming powerful, or already is powerful, and who we are telling ourselves is still powerful, mm-hmm. right? The truth is, if you look at your tax system and how much tax is going outside the UK because of the tech oligarchs, you know, if you look at your surveillance systems or, you know, monitoring systems and who actually controls the data and what else are they doing with it? I think I'm never going to be welcomed into this, you know, city again because of what I'm saying. But genuinely, this is a wake-up moment for everyone. The reality of the matter is this is the ultimate, I said it's the ultimate equalizer, but it's also the ultimate differentiator. And government has to start waking up very strongly to how, you know, your nation can be completely controlled by others who are not other governments.
And how long do you think the government, we, have to try and turn this around from the vision that you see?
If I tell you that there is a major risk to your democracy approaching, would you ask me how long would it take? Or would you start
how
acting
long?
Now?
Right.
There are
okay,
real...
So you think it's imminent. Let me just say, before I do... that you mentioned Palantir. I have to say, Palantir are obviously not here to speak themselves, but they have said many times that they do not own, control or sell data. And they say they take a rigorous approach to respecting human rights. That is their right of reply, and I must give it. The man there in the white shirt with glasses.
Going back to the hide from machines, just two areas where I do think that there is space for government intervention and also where the UK can differentiate itself. The first is around data privacy, and there's a wealth of data in organisations like the NHS, which we don't want to touch because of the care that's needed. But if we could solve for data privacy, that would open up a huge opportunity. The other is around intellectual property. At the moment, it's the Wild West, and everything can be harvested. Particularly people in the arts are being, they're having their data taken with no compensation. Again, if UK law could start to move into this space, it could solve for something that hasn't been solved for anywhere else.
Man there in the black top and the colourful jacket, yeah.
I'm not the incurable optimist. However, I listened to Mo and I think that this is a leveller. And most of the conversation has been on the fear side. And I'll give my own personal experience, right? My daughter was 2 months old, misdiagnosed. 2 years old, same daughter, misdiagnosed again, right? I got ADHD, I'm 54-odd, right? And only got diagnosed last year. With the help of AI, I was able to, like the lady in front said, I was able to go through my own life, right, and look at patterns, failed relationships, successful relationships, all that lovely stuff, work and all that. It helped me come to a place comfortably with AI to say, I think you have ADHD. So for 2 years, I went around saying, undiagnosed ADHD, all right? Last year, I got the assessment and ADHD. Here's the out of the tunnel, right? Since then, I didn't finish university, right? I haven't finished most things. Since then, I'm doing an MBA for AI, right? I filed a patent, this guy, right? Filed a patent last month for a medical diagnostic tool that helps brown and black skin. I found that.
AI
has allowed me to file a patent, okay. Right? I'm doing MBA because I need to learn more about it, right? Okay. And just very quickly,
I've only got about 15 seconds left. So will you forgive me if I just bring the panel in?
The government need to educate us on this unknown,
the use of AI. So, how do we end? Listen, you've got about 10 seconds, Laura. So good luck. But how should we come out of this debate feeling positive and excited, negative and terrified, or somewhere in between?
You have to feel positive. We need relentless optimism because this is something we have to win. For me, it is not about, you know, necessarily going off and building an expensive British model, but let's move this all open source. Let's have solutions.
Which means everyone can access the data.
Everybody can access the models. Build models that we share worldwide that have the democratic values built in, that everyone can use. They can start their own companies. They can afford it, and the costs come down. And that, for me, is the first thing to do.
Okay, we are out of time. Okay. Well, do we feel more informed? Yes. God, for a minute when you pause, I thought you were going to just like leave me hanging. Yes, good. That's the answer I was hoping for anyway, and I hope you do at home as well. To our panel, to our real human panel, thank you so much for taking part. To all of you, how brilliant you put your questions and your thoughts. Thank you so much for taking part in this special programme. And of course, thank you to you at home for watching. Remember, we are in Makerfield next week. Politics as usual. Bring it on. Quite a lot happening there. Yes, so that's next Thursday. But for now, from Dulwich on our special programme about AI. Goodbye.